Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Rowan Hisayu Buchanan, the author of Harmless Like You and Starling Days. She is also the editor of Go Home, an anthology of Asian diasporic writers' musings on the notion of home, and Dog-Hearted, essays on our fierce and familiar companions. Before we jump into our conversation, Rowan has graciously allowed me to include a short excerpt from The Sleepwatcher, her forthcoming third novel, arriving on April 20th. You can find a link in the show notes and pre-order your copy today.
I have never returned to the town. I rarely say its name. Only that I grew up a few hours from London. I left before I turned 17. The sea is now a train ride away, but sometimes I see a gull making its white-bellied way through the air to pilfer from our bins or perform some other bastard behavior. Yesterday I saw two, one swooping after the other in brutality or romance. I told myself I would tell you what happened in that town. I started wrong. Do you remember? It was while we were making dinner at your flat. Your knife shuttled through the onion. You were blinking back acid tears. Maybe I felt braver because you weren't looking at me. I mentioned the town and added, almost casually, do you know, while I was living there, I stopped dreaming. Who can blame you for the reply? Other people's dreams are always boring. I didn't argue that this was not a dream, but an absence. Instead, I gathered onion peel, swiping the husk into my hand. I have to try again. It wouldn't be fair to wind myself around your life before I tell you what happened in that place. It's not a thing I have perspective on, even 12 years later. The memories are salty and humid. Perhaps you'll say I was barely out of childhood and that my mistakes were understandable. I hope that afterwards you will still want to pack your stuff for me to box mine and for us to conjoin our lives. Or maybe you'll never be able to knot your fingers around mine, because when you see my hands, you'll remember the damage they've done. You'll decide I'm not the sort of person you want to live with after all. Well, you have no time for dreams. You've always had time for books. Whenever I borrow one from your shelves, I trace the graphite underlinings and marvel at your careful attention and the luck of your students. So I thought I'd try to write you one, or something like one anyway. An account with a beginning, a middle, an end.
Hi, Rowan. It's so nice to be able to connect with you all the way across the pond. And we caught up just briefly before we started recording, but how has life been in 2023? You've had quite the journey already, I think.
Thank you for asking. Thank you for having me on your podcast. It's an honor. So 2023 is good. I'm based in the UK, for anyone listening, and despite this accent. And in the UK, I have a novel coming out this April, and I have an anthology that I edited. Well, it came out last week. We went doing a bunch of events for that.
Congratulations.
And so there's sort of a bunch going on artistically, and I have a new member of my family. I have a baby. So yeah, it's just a lot of juggling.
A lot of juggling at the top of the year. Yeah. Congrats again, by the way, on the release of the anthology. You do quite a bit of work in supporting anthologies, which I also love, alongside your novels, including Harmless Like You, your debut novel, which came out in 2016. It seems so long ago. And Starling Days, which came out in 2019. And this is such a question that I think you answer at the top of any conversation in an interview. But, you know, in your books and in your bio, you really strongly emphasize that you identify as Japanese, British, Chinese, American. And I sort of love that for you because of the power to claim that. And I also love that so many people would identify as mixed race. But inside of that, there's a lot of mystery, and two people who are mixed race can come from completely different worlds. So I love that identification. How is that working for you these days? Because you've really had to talk about this quite a bit in interviews. It's so integral to your vision.
Thank you for asking. And I have to say, that's a conversation that I found myself thinking about in many different ways. It first started because my debut novel, is about a Japanese artist living in New York who ends up abandoning her son. It's about sort of how and why that happens, and a bit from his point of view as well. And I think my publishers were a bit like, people sort of don't know who you are, what Rowan Hisayu Buchanan, where does that come from? Why do you care about this story? And so they wanted me to include my Japanese background in my bio so that people would understand that, who didn't know that Hisayu was a Japanese name.
I see.
But of course, I also have all these other bits of who I am, so I couldn't just say, I'm a bit Japanese, the rest, you'll have to guess. I guess I could have, but I didn't. People often ask me about it, and I found myself, at first I was a bit surprised by how much interest there was in it, and I didn't know, should I be offended? Does it seem just like a weird thing? But I ended up having very joyful conversations with people about the different paths their families have taken, and in some of those cases it might be some other person who's half Asian, half white, very similar, going, see you, it's really similar. But it could equally be someone with a very different background to me, but who saw something in just the unexpected meeting. And that's been a really lovely thing that came from something that was almost purely practical when it was introduced to me.
Do you have people come up to you then with these identifications, and also how it's really threaded throughout all of your stories? Do you have people come up to you with, hey, this resonated with me because of my complex background, and I didn't have a black and white narrative about where I come from and what my ancestry is like?
Yes, I have. And, it's funny. I actually, I've had those conversations with people who are much more on the surface outsiders, or what we often call minorities, although people point out the global majority isn't a white man from Maine. A lot of those conversations have been about sort of otherness, but one of the ones that really stands out to me is my first editor, a lovely blonde hair, she looked, and I mean this totally neutrally, like a white lady, she said, this story really resonated with me because my family's English, but I grew up in Scotland, and so I didn't fit in there. And then I moved back to England, but I felt too Scottish for England. And, if I'd seen her on the street, I would have thought, you definitely fit in. Your story is going to be very basic. And that would have been my own prejudice and my own blindness. Mm-hmm. And actually realizing that people you might not expect would have complex identities that they're wrestling with, I think was an important reminder for me.
Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out. It's so surprising how different stories might resonate with people that even surprise the author and the creator, right? When I was doing a little bit of research about your debut novel, even though I knew you then, I wasn't paying attention to your process so much. And I didn't realize you had this story about what you think caused your debut novel to have this bidding war and its massive attention in the beginning, which is that you believe it was because you and your novel were struck by lightning.
I'll tell the story and then say what I think about it. But so I had been offered a place at the Edison Vincent Millay Writers Colony, and partially because I was a member of the Asian American Writers Workshop Margins Fellowship, which, if you identify as being Asian American, really check out. It's a wonderful thing. It was a big thing for me in the beginning stages of my career. Yes. But they organized this stay at the Edison Vincent Millay Colony. All of the studios and the bedrooms that we were staying in were in this barn that I believe is one of those old barns that was ordered in a catalogue back in the day and, put together. One night, I was working, it was summer, but it was stormy. And so I was just plugged into my headphones, editing away. And my headphones were plugged into my computer. My computer was plugged into the wall. And I wasn't paying a lot of attention because I'd just gotten an agent and she'd given me all these changes to make. And I'd done them by hand, I was writing them up. Then suddenly like my vision blanked out just for a couple of seconds. And I had this horrible pain in sort of my head and my side. If I'd been struck directly by lightning, I'd probably be dead or at least horribly injured, but I hadn't been. What had happened was the barns, like I think it was a fuse box, but sort of the electricity in the barn had been hit by lightning. And that had sent this big surge into all of the electrics.
Yeah.
And so a friend, like one of the other fellows, their phone charger was destroyed and sort of like burnt out. Somebody else, again, I think had a device of theirs just broke because of this electricity surge. The reason I was in pain was essentially my body had grounded the charge. It had gone up through the computer, into the headphones, into my body, and then through my body. And that was why I was in pain. And, you know, it was, therefore, it was a tiny fraction of that lightning bolt. It was not the main, you know, big thing. I don't want to.
Good, you're still with us. Yeah.
But if I hadn't been wearing headphones, I might have lost all my edits because I was not great at remembering to press save. So I was at least very grateful for that. You know, I felt like I should decide, were the thunder gods cursing me or blessing me? And I decided that they were blessing me. You know, I don't know how seriously I believe that, but it's a fun thing to believe. And if something's fun to believe in, it's not hurting anyone and it's not leading you to make bad decisions, I generally say go for it.
Oh, absolutely. Are you typically someone who's looking for synchronicities, or are you someone with who looks for a sign? For example, I'm a double air sign in my astrological chart. So birds, I tend to look out for birds and things in the sky.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that. I think, and this is at the risk of sounding very pretentious, I like to notice what I am noticing. The part of the reason for this, and maybe my most superstitious belief, is that in all of my novels, there's been something that I wrote about that later came true in some way in my life. So my first novel, there are lines of dialogue that Yuki, the protagonist's husband, says to her that my now partner, who hadn't I met before the book was published, but he didn't have access to it, he hadn't read it, said to me almost verbatim early on. And he's not the same as that character, he's a different person. I also haven't abandoned him and my child. But I remember just thinking, what?
Yeah.
How has that happened? And so, you know, and there are other sort of other strange echoes. Now, obviously, there are many things I've written about that have not come true.
Right.
So, you know, it's not, I'm not saying that I can make myself win the lottery, sadly for me. But what I've come to believe is that whether it is the collective unconsciousness or the trickster gods, or maybe it's just me noticing my interest, reaching out for certain things and pulling those things towards me in my life, you know, both in fiction and in writing and then in the world, or equally, if it's a bad thing that happens, maybe there were hints of it that my conscious mind wasn't aware of and that my unconscious mind put into the work.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know what to attribute it to, but I think if you see something and you think it's a sign, there's a good chance that it is, if only because you believe it to be so.
Right. Oh, that must have been such a funny experience or strange experience when that happened, that your partner said to you what you had already written. Wow, I'm going to be thinking about that one. And between Harmless Like You and Starling Days, were your writing experiences vastly different between the writing process for your debut novel and your sophomore novel, or are they more similar?
Okay, so I think, you know, in some ways, as artists, we all have particular habits or particular ways, you know, ways into things. But I think the biggest difference, and maybe this will be useful for people beginning their artistic journeys, was just knowing that I could do it. And I didn't know necessarily that it was going to be great, or that even that second novel was going to definitely work out. But when you're writing your first novel, I think there's a real sense of, you do not know, even if you can write enough words, if those words are going to make sense, if there's going to be an ending, if it's going to pull together. And I think that can give you a real sense of impatience, because the impatience is actually fear. It's, I don't know if this is going to work, and living with the uncertainty of not knowing if this is going to work is difficult, painful even sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
And I think once you've done a large creative project, in my case a novel, but I suspect it's similar in different genres of art, you know that you are capable of doing that, that you are capable of pulling all of the threads together and of creating something cohesive that you believe in, at the very least.
Yeah.
I think that is very reassuring and can allow you to feel more able to take risks and to be a little gentler with yourself and play a little more.
Yeah. I love that for you. I read in an interview of yours that the first draft is always a discovery process. It's, in some ways, it's kind of when perhaps things feel most alive. But then you also have a pretty disciplined and rigorous editing process, like a lot of novelists wind up having to. So I love that you kind of pointing out how it can be challenging sometimes, but also times where you can experience that freedom in some ways to explore as an artist. Who was a writer or a mentor that had a profound impact on you, either personally or maybe even for your career?
So career-wise, and I guess life-wise, when I was trying to decide where to go to grad school, because I was lucky enough to have a couple offers in a couple different places, I ended up choosing to move to Madison, Wisconsin, because there was a writer at the time there who was teaching, whose name is Laurie Moore. And she is a short story writer. You know, if, for those who don't know her work, you can find many of her stories in The New Yorker. And I really admired her voice and her stories. And so I ended up choosing to go there to study. So she'd already had an effect before I even met her, because I had gone to the middle of the country just from the love of her stories.
Where were you at the time?
Where was I? I had been living in New York, and then I'd moved back to London. I'm confusing different stages of my life. I had been at Columbia University for my undergrad and in New York. And so I went from there to Madison. I would later go back to England and dart back and forth.
Yeah, you have multiple locations, as listeners will know, yes.
And I have to say, London and New York like to think of themselves as being incredibly unique cities. And at the risk of offending the vast number of people on both continents, I would say that London and New York have quite a lot in common. And they are much more similar than they are different. There are differences, but it was not a huge culture shock going between them. It was a huge culture shock moving to the Midwest.
Yeah.
Though I am, no one can see me, but I am wearing a plaid shirt during this podcast. So clearly some of it stuck with me.
Yeah, shout out to Wisconsin.
So yeah, and she was kind enough to be one my thesis reader. She gave me a quote that I think helped me find my first book deal. And I'm incredibly grateful to her. That said, I think, well, I know that I've been lucky to meet and to study with many different writers, and I think they've all had, you know, in different ways, a huge effect on my work. So there were writers at Wisconsin whose work I wasn't familiar with before I got there, but whose patience and time and thoughtfulness in reading my work and in conversations with them really, you know, changed me. The other person who was my thesis supervisor was a writer named Judith Mitchell, Judith Claire Mitchell, and she is one of the kindest people I know, and I think she's fostered generations of writers who come out of that program. So I'm very grateful to her too. And then you asked me a question, I'm just too grateful to too many people.
Oh, please, go on.
But then, you know, there are all of the amazing, especially Asian American writers whose just their work existing, even though if I've never met them or I've met them only briefly, has, you know, given me confidence and faith in what I was doing. Alexander Chi, who actually did end up being my official mentor under the Asian American Writers Workshop, you know, I was reading his work before I ever met him. In fact, they said, who do you want to be your mentor? And I was like, please, Alexander Chi. And he is a half Korean writer. Ruth Ozeki, who is half Japanese. They gave me ways to think and talk about mixedness. You know, I've been able to speak to both of them a little since, but just their work itself, I think, was a guiding light.
Yes, just to see the work of fellow Asian Americans and people who explore these themes is so impactful. And you're making me think about the lineage of mentor mentees for artists and writers, right? That's a real thing of fostering that down the road. And you also do a little bit of that yourself. You offer private mentorship and editing services, and you also will offer novel feedback. So is there an exercise or a writing tip that you tend to offer to writers a lot just based on your experience?
Okay. I'm going to do two things. One, I'm going to give a piece of general advice that no one will listen to. Then I'll give a writing exercise that you can choose to do if you want, but you don't have to do if you don't want to.
Oh, perfect.
So the piece of advice that I would give you, and this relates to something we were talking about earlier, is even if it feels impossible, let yourself be messy, be patient with yourself, get the words down. Once you have the words, once you have a rough, shaggy beast of a story, you can trim, you can edit, you can see what's missing. But if you don't get it down, if you wait for every sentence to be perfect, there is a decent chance you're not gonna write anything. That's partially because your brain is literally using energy to remember your ideas. And once you've written them down, you free up space to have more ideas and to think critically about them.
Oh my God, you're so right.
I know, it's silly, but yeah, no one will listen to me. But that's my real and probably most useful piece of advice I can give anyone. The thing I will offer anyone who wants to write fiction that I find that people enjoy doing is a lot of new writers struggle with place. You know, you'll hear people talking about like place as a character and you think, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I think it tends to mean one of two things, or possibly both. One, that place be specific and memorable rather than generic. So, you know, there's not a cafe, but, you know, is this a London builder's cafe where they offer you jacket potato with 10 different types of topping? Is it a Brooklyn cafe with exposed light bulbs and, you know, things wiggling down? And secondly, that setting has an effect on the plot, that it causes something to happen or change that could not have happened or changed in that way in a different place. So it's my run-up. Think of a place that you know really, really well. And that could be an apartment, it could be a street, it could be a school, and draw as badly and did, like, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be accurate, but draw a map of that place. Set a timer of 15 minutes and annotate it as heavily as you can. And by that, you know, you might want to put like, this place always stinks, this bit's cold, you know, there's a dog that barks there, and pay a special attention to anything that is potentially dangerous within that space and anything that is potentially precious. And the reason I use potentially is it doesn't have to be to you. You can just imagine that someone would find those things that way. Mm-hmm. So for example, in Wisconsin, I live in an apartment with an oven that was really, really old. And at one point you had to light it by kneeling on the floor and using, you know, a long lighter with a flame on top. And at one point I was very tired. And the gas, I had let the gas, I hadn't, it had gone out, and I let, rather than turning off the gas, waiting, then relighting, I just stuck the thing in and it burned off my fringe. You know, that was a dangerous thing in my apartment, you know, so labeling all of those. And when you've done that and you've given yourself 15 minutes, put a character who isn't you into that space. Think about where in that space they are. Are they near the dangerous thing? Are they near the precious thing? What is going to activate precious thing? So for example, the precious thing could be jewelry, but it could be a baby, you know. It's a thing that your character or another character finds precious and will be upset if it was destroyed or damaged or lost or stolen. Equally, the dangerous thing, you know,
right?
I don't think I need to explain to you intelligentness is what dangerous. And when you do that, the place will become part of the story, because it's not just background, it's not just backdrop that's pretty. And where you're like, how many adjectives do I really need? And then you can think, oh, I'm going to actually invoke the description that this area is cold. Or no, I'm not. It's not useful or relevant. But you have all of those, like, it's like a resource map for you and that story. And you can choose when to draw on it and when not to. So that's my specific for fiction writers exercise.
Well, thank goodness this is recorded, because I was about to pull out my notebook. I was getting so inspired just by listening to someone who with that experience. Yes. And people, please connect with Rowan. I'll have a hyperlink with your website if they're interested in connecting with you further. It would be immensely useful. One theme that you have in your work is looking at generations and generational trauma, and also generational healing, I would say. I'll read a quick quote. "A lot of what Harmless Like You is about is how pain shapeshifts down the generations. There's nothing more personal than family, and yet families are so profoundly affected by political decisions. Interesting time we're living in now where that is still very relevant. And as a mother now and a parent, I'm curious, has that experience colored your perspective on generational ties, or has it had an influence in looking at your previous works, particularly Harmless Like You, I would say?"
Okay, so, well, for anyone who can hear the tiny person trying to chime in the background and is wondering, why is this woman being on a podcast? Surely she should be tending to that creature. Do feel reassured that my partner is currently with her and whispering sweet nothings into her ear. She's just
absolutely
responding vocally. She's not been abandoned in a corner. And I think how it's changed, I mean, I think I do still believe that very strongly. And it is not just, but I think the shape-shifting is important. It's not just that it gets passed down. We are not necessarily doomed to repeat exactly what came before.
Mm-hmm.
But each generation has to address or deal with it in some way. And the optimist in me would like to believe that gradual healing is possible, that we are, with the help of our communities, with friends, when assuming that that generation has the support it needs, are able to process and heal from trauma. I hope we're not all doomed. I think what's changed for me as a parent is having a real sense of the ongoingness of the process, that it is not just how I have handled things in the past, but it's how I handle them now and how I handle them in the future, and that I don't have full control. I would love to have full control. I don't have full control of what she takes from me, but I can do my best, and I can do my best to make it a light enough load to carry, and that is a large part of the work of being a parent, other than changing nappies and
right,
doing all the rest.
Yeah, and I'm sure something you'll continue to explore, including some of your upcoming works. Real quickly though, I really want to ask you this. What is your definition of home, if you have one?
So, you know, the answer to this question has changed for me, and I think changes day to day, moment to moment, mood to mood. But I think for me, it is in the connection to those I'm closest to. Now, that is family, but it's also the relationships with, people often call them chosen family. I don't know how listeners feel about that term, but the people I'm closest to and the stories that we carry together, the references that can be lightly dropped and refer to a whole decade or a whole history that you can just say, oh, you know, that time. And I think in those conversations and in those spaces is when I feel most at home.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Rowan. I don't want to let you go before you dive into two more things. One is, you briefly mentioned that you have taken up some practice in art therapy, and I also know you to be quite the visual artist. In fact, I still have a painting, a watercolor painting, I believe, that you made of me. I still have it here somewhere. So do you still get a chance to, you know, as a new mother, that might be a bit challenging, but still practice visual arts? And how does your experience as an artist, writer, factor into art therapy and your interest in it?
Okay, so in the past couple of weeks, I've been doing less visual art, but it's been with me for most of my life, and I expect I'm going to continue to have it. I think it's very important for me, part of my creative process, because making visual art for me is very much about the act of noticing, and trying to see what is there in the world rather than what I think is there. And that feeds into my fiction writing, feeds into my even my nonfiction writing, you know. And it may be that in visual art, I'm trying to notice many more visual details and it will make it into a novel. It may just be in a single metaphor, but it also slows me down. It allows me to really be in a place, absorb its atmosphere, to think clearly. And so I'm very grateful for it. I think in terms of art therapy, that's something that I'm just beginning training in. So, you know, I don't have any hugely authoritative statements about it. But the reason that it's something that I'm entering to training in is what I one of the things I found, especially with my one-on-one mentees, but also just talking to other people in the creative arts, is that there is a part of art making that is very much not therapy, is craft, is care for your audience, is the construction of something for others.
Right.
But that for many writers and artists, the creation of the art, A, has a healing function, but B, sometimes healing needs to be done in order to make the art as well, in order to get to that bit
Yeah.
where you're giving it to other people, where it's something that can bring other people joy or sorrow or whatever it is you're trying to summon. You have to be able to hold on to your own emotions and to, if not have perfect control of them, to not have them be swallowing you. When I found myself working with a couple of the people I've worked with, so much of that work was helping them metabolize things they'd been through in order to make them into art. And I thought, I'm doing the best I can with these people, and I'm very proud of the work that they've done. But I would love to have more training in this and to have a deeper understanding of it, so that where that is important for people, I can help them
Yeah.
and feel confident in that help.
Yeah. When you mentioned that you were that you're practicing and training in it, I was like, this is perfect. This is so Rowan with your advocacy for mental health, and that we have an open conversation about mental health alongside your craft and your artistic nature. I thought this is such a wonderful addition to everything else you already bring to the table. And I wish we had more time. In fact, we can have such a long and in-depth conversation about life in general. But to keep it somewhat concise, I know that you have a forthcoming novel coming out called The Sleep Watcher. And also you mentioned you had just launched an anthology that you're a part of and contributed to. Is there anything that you want to say about anything that you're working on or anything people can look forward to?
The Sleep Watcher is mostly being distributed, I believe, in the UK, and in, I think, Australia. But you can order it if you're in America, and the Brits will send it to you. And and that novel is about it's a woman talking to her lover and confessing something that happened a long time ago when she was a teenager, and she began to have these out-of-body experiences during the night, and she is forced to see things happening in her family that she was able to ignore during the day. And so that is, you know, a book that I'm very excited for, and you know, I hope people enjoy, and is coming out very soon in the UK. And I won't, you know, spoil what happens or the ending. And the anthology, which just came out, and again, this is UK based, is called Dog-Hearted, after a quote in King Lear where he describes his ungrateful daughters as dog-hearted. And it's an anthology of different writers writing about their relationships with their dogs. And you know, in one case it's a rescue husky who your owner has to feed blood to soothe her. In one case it's a woman who's had terrible childhood abuse, but who's like healing with while healing a rescue dog. In one case, it's a woman who wrote a list of everything she wanted in a partner, and she forgot to write that he should like dogs. And she got like that person appeared, but he didn't like dogs, and how she dealt with it. So it's, you know, it's been really fun to work on. I sort of thought of it as my fun project, because the previous anthology that I edited was about sort of the Asian American experience and the experience of home and whether you could even feel at home. And so I was like, this is books about dogs. It's going to be so lighthearted and so fun. And some of the essays are, but I found that, you know, the writer, you know, Esme Wuzhan Wang was writing about deep mental health things, you know, that it was away from what the environment and nature and man's responsibility and death. And I was like, oh, okay, nothing is simple. And so, you know, that's been really fun to work on too.
Oh, thank you so much for having your voice out there and being sort of an example for other people developing the courage to put their work out into the world. And everybody, please look forward to these when they get published, or if they're already out, please look for that online. Thank you so much for your time today, Rowan. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate you opening up your time, especially as a new parent. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real joy to talk to you again, and I want to hear all that's going on with you, but I think I can't bother our podcast with that. What? Although, you know, I'm sure they want to know what's going on with you too.
I'm sure they do. Yes, we got to catch up more in depth later. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with me about the podcast or about my services, you can find me on Instagram at Robert Kwong Home, or you can find me through my coaching website at www.robertkwongcoaching.com.